funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to get back on your feet after losing a job? Even when we suspect a round of layoffs might affect us, indeed, even when we dislike the job we've lost, unemployment can take not just an economic toll, but an emotional one. And for anybody who hasn't had to look for a job in years, the new world of personal branding, online networking, and digital applications can make us feel out of step with the pace of things today. But as my guest will tell us, he has learned from both personal experience and extensive research that it is possible to use the hunt for new employment to carve out a fulfilling new direction for our careers. Dwayne Schenck is an independent communications consultant and author of the new book, Reset, How to Beat the Job Loss Blues and Get Ready for Your Next Act. He joins us today as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. Dwayne, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
You know, most of us can anticipate the financial stresses of losing a job, but it seems like we're taken aback by how bad we feel about ourselves when we're out of work, even if we're affected by layoffs that are not related to our performance on the job. Why does that come as such a surprise?
That's right. I mean, this, you know, a lot of times what people forget is we're very good thinking tactically, but what we don't take into account is the psychological effect of what a job loss, you know, and how it affects you. And I mean, that happened to me, and what I found in my journey in writing this book and how it all came about was just, you know, how devastating it is. And I don't know that there's one answer as to, you know, why that is. I think as human beings, we're pretty resilient and we're hopeful and you know, we're constantly striving to do better and be better at what we do. And then when we get knocked for a loop, and especially when something like a job loss, whether you're let go, laid off, downsized, fired, whatever the case may be, it comes as such a blow. It comes as such a shock. And even if you see it coming and know you see the writing on the wall, as I did, I mean, I had a little bit of warning, I still went into this denial. I went into this whole denial process, and so, you know, and really what I learned and what I really wrote about, and I couldn't find anything out there that addressed this, and that's part of the reason why I wrote the book was how do you keep your sanity and your identity while looking for a job, especially in the worst job market since the Great Depression, you know, and be successful at landing a position. So it was a double whammy. I mean, even in a good market, it can be psychologically very damaging. And, you know, one of the, I found a statistic that I put in the book where many studies show that just being out of work 6 months can cause permanent psychological effects, damaging psychological effects that you know, you don't really get over. So if you think about that, this is real stuff.
And you also point out here that a job loss affects the entire family and not simply because the whole family is cutting back on spending. There's more to it than that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's the whole dynamic. I mean, it does go back to how does the person who lost their job deal with it? And, you know, what are they going through? And I think that, you know, what I did and a lot of people do is you try to, at least at first, keep things as normal as possible in the household. I mean, I have fairly young kids, and so, I mean, high school and middle school, and, you know, you don't want them to all of a sudden get nervous or feel like, oh my God, you know, what's happening? Are we gonna be kicked out on the street? Or you try to keep their lifestyle as normal as possible. You know, but the reality is they know what's going on. They're very smart. They know, they see, they sense, they smell the stress in the house. They see cutting back. You know, for me, and the book is written, it's not gloom and doom and heavy. It's a heavy subject, but there's humor in it. Mm-hmm. And throughout, and so it makes it very readable. But, you know, you do cut back, and they see that. They see you cut a cable show that they used to like to watch, or you cut the garbage service because you're saving $25 a month. You can just drive down to the dump and do it yourself, that kind of thing. So the whole family dynamic, and it affects your marriage. I mean, if you're married, or it affects your relationship with your significant other, your partner, or whoever you happen to be living with, or friendships. I mean, typically, when you lose a job, you start to isolate and you start to pull back, and you tend to do all the things you really shouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the book really helps to show you that you need to start thinking counterintuitively about what you're going through. You shouldn't feel shame. I mean, nowadays people are changing jobs on a pretty regular basis, and I don't think there's anybody today that hasn't lost a job, or you have yourself lost a job. I mean, this happened to be the first time I ever lost a job, but I don't even know that that's the norm.
So this is something that I think a lot of people can relate to who've been through this experience. Initially for you, when the axe fell, because you had been working for a boss that seems to have been threatened by your ambition, you were not entirely surprised, but you experienced what you later learned to recognize as this thing called fake bliss. Will you define that for us?
Yeah, it was something that actually, it was a term that I picked up from a friend of mine who was the one who inspired me to write the book in the first place, and that was Mika Brzezinski. And I so related to it. And, whether it's a pink bliss or fake bliss, it's this sense that, especially when you've been working successfully, you've had your own businesses at time. I mean, I had my own business going into the recession. When the recession hit, I ended up losing clients and then had to jump into, a job where I worked for a corporation. But I had a sense of confidence that when I lost this job, I thought, well, if they don't want me, I'll go out and find something better. I'll show them. And there was that sense that I call fake bliss. I felt almost relieved. There was a sense of relief that, wow, I'm finally out from under this. Mm-hmm. And, I'm not even using half of the skills that I could really use anyway, so I'm going to go out and do something bigger and better. That is a false sense of reality, because in this job market, and I wasn't thinking straight on this job market. I mean, I didn't, and I don't know that I had any reason to. I mean, my wife was very grounded. I mean, I called her when I told her I lost my job. I mean, she was, boom, she knew exactly what we were going to face, and I was like, yeah, come on, give me a break. But reality set in pretty quickly because it was, at the time, it was 8.5% unemployment, and those numbers weren't real. I mean, it was much higher than that, and there was a huge backlog, millions of people, educated, well-educated people, out of work, and it wasn't just well-educated. I mean, it was blue-collar jobs. It affected everybody. I mean, there was it was a huge blow to the economy. I think the housing bubble alone sucked something like, when it burst, $7.5 trillion out of the economy. So this was unprecedented. And so I soon, quickly, learned that in my geographic area, there were no VP communication jobs available. And that was a rude awakening.
Well, and that's something I also want to talk about, the factor of your age. This was all taking place around the time of your 50th birthday. And like, if a midlife crisis hadn't happened yet, there's nothing, that's going to kick you over into one like something like this body blow. And as you mentioned, there aren't, there might be a lot of entry level jobs out there. There aren't necessarily a lot of VP level jobs. And so you were, among other things, trying to decide, well, do I just start over and just take a job for the sake of having a job, or do I hold out?
Yeah, I mean, look, at first I had set up some really good interviews. I had some excellent potential opportunities, and then they fell one by one like dominoes. And I have to say, I was a little shocked that I really felt I was the best candidate for the job. I was making it to the second round and third round, and after three or four experiences of that nature, and seeing that you know, wow, I don't know, you know, what's going wrong, and not getting any feedback. The other thing is, you know, in this market, you're not getting feedback. And it was brought to my attention that, you know, even if you did get feedback, you know, it's not much help. I mean, it doesn't matter. What are they going to tell you? Nobody's going to tell you. I mean, there's liability issues. Nobody's going to say, well, we didn't hire you because, you know, you stutter or something. I mean, it's not going to happen. So, you know, but I mean, it became pretty clear that I was, you know, I was in this for the long haul. And then I started thinking, well, maybe, you know, I better start looking and, lowering the bar, so to speak. You know, I was willing to take a job that paid less, and that's the right thing to do. I mean, you need to be thinking that way. But the problem with that was, as a lot of executives and people are listening to this program, you know, you hiring managers start to look at you as more of a flight risk than anything else. You know, you have the skills, you'd be great to have on board, but, you know, as soon as the market picks up, you know, you're going to find something else, you're going to leave us. Mm-hmm. And that, so you were sort of doomed. It was just this constant, everywhere you turned, you ran into a brick wall.
It's such a shame, and it's ironic that it becomes so hard to find a job after the age of 50, because this is the point at which so many workers, had they been able to stay at their previous employer, were probably among the top producers, were people who were sort of at the height of their skills and experience, and yet still young enough to continue to grow. Why do you think age is, it's not, legally it's not supposed to be a factor, but everybody knows that it is?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we live in a society, I think we live in a society that really covets and really, you know, we live in a very celebrity-driven society. America is very driven by celebrity. We love our role models, we tend to look up to that kind of thing. Youth, advertising has a lot to do with it. The whole world of advertising, celebrates youth and beauty and youngness. I was 49 when I lost my job, and, you know, by no means are you over the hill, and there's plenty of people finding work in their 50s and their mid and late 50s, there's no doubt. But I think it's just there's a culture in our country that you're working against. But I have to say that, you know, there's a lot of hope out there, and the book really talks a lot about, you know, the whole book is about resetting your career and about reinventing yourself, and you can overcome this age discrimination. Yes, age discrimination is alive and well, but there's ways around it. You know, you have to pick and choose the right opportunities. There's plenty of companies looking for, you know, the wisdom and experience that, you know, middle-aged, you know, 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds have. I mean, I must say, in the book, I interviewed Donnie Deutsch, who is a very successful ad executive for Deutsch Advertising, and he was very blunt about the fact that, you know, if you're 50 years old or older, give up a career and a corporate career. Just, you know, take a hard right turn. You're never getting back in the corporate world. You're never going to be able to climb that ladder again. It's a young man's gig, and it sounds harsh, but you know what? You do also, you know, don't, you can't just sweep under the rug or live or turn a blind eye to that. That's okay. Work it to your advantage. You know, what should you do? Okay, you're 55 years old. You've been working at a corporation for, 15 years. You lost your job. You don't even have an up-to-date resume. What should you be thinking? Well, you know what? Maybe now's the time to start your own company, you know, and start looking at what are your passions. You know, maybe as a kid you loved fish and you worked in an aquarium store and that's your passion. Well, you know, with technology today, it doesn't take a lot of money. You can open up an internet store, perhaps. I'm just using this as an example.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break, and then we will talk more about this. My guest is Dwayne Schenck. His new book is called Reset, How to Beat the Job Loss Blues and Get Ready for Your Next Act. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with communications consultant Dwayne Schenck. He is the author of the new book, Reset: How to Beat the Job Loss Blues and Get Ready for Your Next Act. He's with us today as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can email think@kera.org, send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or call 1-800-933-5372. So, Dwayne, you were saying that it might just be an opportunity, and it doesn't feel that way, I suppose, in the short term always, but it might be an opportunity to find a new way to use all your skills, but in a different venue. One thing I want to go back to is this idea of branding ourselves online. For many people that might have worked for the same company for the past 15 years or so, this wasn't necessary the last time they were job hunting.
Right.
Now we have Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter. What do we do with these sites, and what does it mean to use them most effectively?
Well, I think a lot of people that are sort of in their middle aged, I'm 50, and the book seems to hit that age group. Although a lot of people coming out of college are reading the book, and I think that many people 50 and above, the whole social media platforms are new to them, or it makes them nervous, and it's really amazing how few people embrace it or use it. And whenever I'm talking, and to whomever I'm speaking with, whether it be a speaking engagement or like this, is that you just got to make it very simple. It's simply a communication tool. It's just about communicating. It's a very easy tool to use, and you have to embrace it today. And probably the most important tool out there for job seekers is LinkedIn. I mean, it's really the best, social media platform for the business world and the business person. And it's free. I mean, if you're not on LinkedIn, I just heard yesterday a radio program in Los Angeles talking about if you're not on LinkedIn, you're not even on the map.
Hmm.
Because it's the de facto tool today for recruiters. Recruiters and people who are looking for employees and candidates, that's what they use today. There used to be software and all kinds of programs that recruiting companies and employment companies would purchase, and they build their databases on these proprietary softwares. Well, today, they use LinkedIn. And if you're not on it, then you're not showing up on their radar. And if you're not showing up on their radar, then you're making it a lot more difficult to find a job. And it's so easy. The system is so easy to use. You put up it's basically a virtual resume.
Yeah.
And, I mean, resumes are important. There's no doubt, and you should have a resume. But I would say it's almost secondary today to having a good LinkedIn site, because when somebody that's looking for an employee gets a resume, 9 times out of 10, they'll look at that resume briefly. I mean, they'll get the name maybe. But they'll go to the LinkedIn profile. They'll go to LinkedIn right away. To get the information, see what groups you belong to, what are your keywords on there, what are your skill sets. They can get that stuff so quickly. Who are you connected with? Where did you go to school? It's a tool that if you're not using, and you're missing out. And it's very easy to get information. There's lots of resources out there today. You can just Google how to. There's books written about it, but there's nothing. There's no mystery to it. It's not a black art, but it is something that's very important. And this is obvious. Look, I'm sure there are people listening to this that this might sound very obvious, but there's a lot of people it's not that obvious. And it's important for them to know that, this is out there and you need to be on it.
We should say, for people who are maybe new to the idea of LinkedIn, it is a great tool. People definitely use it, but it's not as if you can put your resume on there and sit back and cross your arms and wait for the jobs to come pouring in. There's more to it than that.
Yeah, but no. I mean, and you want to be active on it. I mean, the way to use it is obviously you're reaching out. You're looking to connect with others. So you're reaching out to friends and colleagues. And you send an invite, you want to connect, they connect with you. And as you become more active, people start sending you a message to connect with them, and then that allows you then to see their connections, and you see this grows exponentially, that that you know all of a sudden you have 100, 200, 300 connections, but exponentially that puts you in touch with you know hundreds of thousands of people because it goes one and two and three levels out. Well, how is that good for you in looking for a job? Well, one of the things you can do is you can do searches with it. You can do some advanced searches where you can look at your connections and type in companies that you're interested in, and then all your connections that are working at that company will come up. Well, great. Now you can reach out to those people. Maybe they can help with an introduction, or you can find out more information. The other thing that's important, again, you're right, you have to be active. You don't just sit back, is that you should join a few groups that are relevant to your field and contribute to those groups. Every once in a while, you know, become a thought leader in your area of expertise. And that means that, you know, write a blog or send a message or start a discussion where you can help other people with your expertise, you know, by giving some information. Because when you join these groups, there's usually a discussion thread and somebody's asking, you know, a question that you might have the answer to, and you can post that. And that just gives you more credibility, and people then remember you and will reach out to you that, again, could lead to a job.
Okay, so I want to talk about this for a minute. You endured a number of what amounted to courtesy interviews where the people you were set up to meet might have been really impressed with you but didn't have a job to offer. You say you really do have to go on these interviews when they become available to you. What's the best way to approach them and glean what you can from them?
I mean, it's kind of funny because, I mean, there's a couple of funny examples in the book that, I mean, I write it in a humorous way because I have sort of a sense of humor. But it's, look, and I coined this phrase. I mean, this, I don't know if anybody refers to it this way, but there is, if you've been interviewing long enough, everybody will relate to the fact that there are the dreaded courtesy interviews. You pretty much know going in that this is not going to turn into a job offer. But and a lot of times the way they come about is a good friend of yours will reach out to a friend of theirs and say, please, will you interview Dwayne or talk to him? He's looking for a job, and he has a lot of the skills you might be interested in. Could you talk to him? Now, that person, out of courtesy and favor to your friend who reached out to them, you know, 9 times out of 10 will say, oh, sure, you know, they're happy to. But that person, what they're not saying is, you know, there's just, I really don't have an opening. There's no way in heck that I'm going to be able to hire this person anytime soon. So, you know, that is what I call a courtesy interview. Should you go on that interview? Should you? Well, the answer is yeah. I mean, because, look, it's good practice. Now, I mean, if you've been interviewing for a year or a year and a half, you know, maybe, I would say you need to do a better job of qualifying interviews, and I'm not sure I would go on an interview like that. But, look, it can't hurt. You never know what will happen. Networking is the key to success of finding work. And this is just another networking exercise. And I went on one of these interviews with in my case, it was a very high-profile person, so it made perfect sense to go. Who knows what will happen? And actually, it did turn out to help me later on after I wrote the book and in my, you know, once I started, you know, my consultancy business. So in the end, it helped. And that is why you need to do stuff like that. It didn't help me immediately. I was desperate. I was in desperate need of a job and was praying that I would get a job as a result of this interview. But in the end, months and months later, this interview resulted in helping me in another way. But, you know, you go on these interviews, and every time you interview, you learn something. You learn something about yourself. You say, oh, I shouldn't have said that. I should have said this. I should have been more prepared. So, but you have to, I think the point is you have to have your mindset what you're getting yourself into. Don't get your expectations too high for these type of interviews, because you're just gonna walk out feeling very depressed.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Warren on the line in Fort Worth. Warren, hi. Can you turn off your radio, please?
Okay, hold on a moment.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, you with us? Yeah, go right ahead.
Yes. Okay.
Go ahead.
Hi, Warren.
Yes,
I'm not sure if you've run across this, but I don't think it's unique where one spouse is, has basically lost their job in their, say, late 40s, and the other spouse is making a fairly good income. And so what that does, even though they're looking for a job, sometimes it's half-hearted, and I think complacency sets in sometimes to where that motivation to go out and to get that job is stifled somewhat. And that's in my particular situation where, we both have advanced degrees, and I'm fortunate to have a good job with the government and well-paying, and so everything is okay on the home front as far as finances and retirement and the whole bit. But on the other end, it's I think that's what has happened. I'm not sure if you've run across that type of situation before or not.
Oh, sure. I mean, look, I think what I'm hearing is I don't know who, which one, but it doesn't sound like if you're in a situation where you don't need to work or you want to work, but you're not in desperate straits, that's a great position to be in, because then you can really follow, again, your passion, as I talked about earlier. You can look into, maybe you turn a hobby into a career, or maybe you learn to become an internet programmer that, you always wanted to learn how to do that, and you build websites or whatever the case may be, or you get involved with, volunteer work. Listen, nonprofit organizations are always looking for smart people, hardworking, dedicated people to help out, whether for a small salary or for free, obviously. And also, by the way, it's important to point out that I just saw a statistic that you up your chances of more than 27% better chance of landing a job if you work for a nonprofit organization, turning into a job.
Another thing, Dwayne, that you experienced was that there are cases in which, obviously prospective employees will meet first with an HR interviewer and later with the actual individual who would be supervising them. And you discovered very often they're not on the same page about even what they want in a prospective employee.
Yeah, I mean, it's a battle. I mean, but you can't, more oftentimes you can't get around it. I mean, the advice you're always going to get from recruiters or anybody that's been in the business, do whatever you can to get right to the decision maker. But that's not always possible. Very often you have to go through the HR department. And usually the HR department, they're the gatekeeper, and they typically don't have, a lot of knowledge or detailed knowledge on, the actual job itself. But they do serve their purpose, and what you have to be very smart about and careful is that they are looking at you as far as, how do you fit? Would you fit culturally? They're looking at you in a different way, your manner, your mannerisms, really it's more of a cultural fit. I mean, some of them will get into some of the details of technically, some of the skills that you have and how you'd fit in a job. But oftentimes, and what I found is when I met with HR, it was more of a chemistry test than an actual get down and talk about here is the job you'll be doing day to day.
I want to talk about this because you mentioned that there are these sort of online applications at a lot of companies, particularly larger companies. And we've discussed this on the show before that these days, because employers can say, I want someone who speaks these three languages and is familiar with these computer programs and graduated in the top 10% of their class, they can put all those qualifications, so then the algorithms are set to knock everybody out of contention who might be really close but doesn't fit those preset criteria. What do you do about that?
Well, I mean, look, I mean, it's the way of the world. Companies today, not all, but a lot of big corporations, they use, a software system, filtering systems that when you send a resume in, it goes right to a machine that is looking for keywords. And so it's important that your resume have those keywords. You have to play by the rules, whatever those rules are. So what you have to do is you got to make sure if you're going for a job and it requires you speak Spanish and that you have experience writing press releases and you do, whatever, five other things, you know, if you don't have that in your resume or those terms in your resume, chances are that resume is going to go, you know, to the wrong pile. So, you know, you have to, that's just what's happening today. I mean, it's always better to find a job through networking. It's always better to be introduced to a company, I guess you could say through the back door. And it happens all the time. 70% of jobs, successfully landed, are done that way. And that's how I landed my job at the corporation that I worked at, that I eventually was let go, is it was through my networking and being introduced to somebody. Now, I ended up having to send my resume in, but it didn't go through a computer. It went direct to an HR person. I would say if you can avoid, that, now, you're better off. So, again, in the book, it goes into really good detail about networking. The book is not, it's not so much about, it's not the how to write a resume and how to do, but it really gives a lot of good advice. I really focus on networking. There's a section in there that's really helpful. And I will tell you this, probably 90% of people that are out of work don't really understand how to do, how to properly network.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know what? When you lose your job, you have to become a student of the process right away. You don't know what you don't know. And so, why would you know how to network? I mean, why would you know a lot of these things? Because you've been working your whole life and you've been climbing the corporate ladder or whatever you're doing. So, this is hard stuff. And so you need to, you need to get after it. You need to get on Google. You need to, buy books that talk about this or that teach you these skills or, these kind of things. It's very important to educate yourself very, very quickly.
Author and communications consultant Dwayne Schenck is our guest as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. His new book is called Reset: How to Beat the Job Loss Blues and Get Ready for Your Next Act. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you: the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Communications consultant Dwayne Schenck is my guest. He's the author of Reset: How to Beat the Job Loss Blues and Get Ready for Your Next Act. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Dwayne, one thing that hasn't changed, at least for you, is that the classic advice about writing a post-interview thank you note still holds. What should that note contain?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big believer in writing hard copy, actually. A lot of people send emails. I think you should send an email, quick email follow-up, but it's a great idea. I do it all the time, to send a short, just go to the store, get those little thank you notes, and send a note. And it's very simple, a couple paragraphs. Nobody has time. Just say, thank you so much. It was a pleasure meeting you. I appreciated the opportunity to have a chance to talk to you about, my skills. And I believe that I could be a real asset here. I would love to join your team. Let me know what the next steps are. I'll follow up in the coming week. Something like that. It's upbeat. It's positive. And believe me, those notes will land on their desk. It'll stay on their desk. They'll get read. Emails, they get buried. They go into spam. But, snail mail and the U.S. Post Office Service is the way to go. Yeah, everything kind of comes full circle, back to the future kind of stuff. But, That's my advice. And people, you know, you really should do that.
I love in the book on page 156, you have things you might try asking the hiring manager after an interview, which is something that it makes perfect sense if you think about it, but I don't think anybody thinks to do it. And it really can, if it doesn't get you the job you want in this interview, maybe it'll help you the next time around.
Yeah, I mean, most people are afraid to ask questions. It's amazing how you go on an interview, and this has happened to me. I mean, the more interviews you do, the more confidence you build, and the more skilled you become as an interviewer. But listen, it's not against the law for you to ask questions too. In fact, most hiring managers, they want you to ask questions. They want you to engage. They want to show they want you to show them that you can think and that you have ideas. You know, it's not just a one-way conversation. And I don't have that page in front of me, but yeah, I think it's, go ahead.
Excuse me for interrupting. It's things like, do you see gaps in my qualifications that I would need to fill? Are there reasons that I'm not qualified? Is there anything I've said today that might hurt my chances of being hired here? In this case, it's not just asking about the company, but it's about really looking carefully at your own performance within the interview.
Yeah, I mean, I came up with those. I mean, those are... if you think about it, those are really, really, pertinent questions that you should ask, because now you might not always get an answer, but a lot of times you will. I've asked questions like that, or like, what would it take for me to get a gold star, here? What would I have to do to make you, your life, better? How could I help you get promoted? Or, what do you see I'm lacking or I should improve on? I mean, think about it. If you can get an honest answer, and a lot of times you can, if you're face-to-face. If you were asking those questions after the fact on, leaving a voicemail or an email, typically you won't get anything. But, most of the time people, if you ask it the right way, not come across as too aggressive, mm-hmm. You will get some very valuable information. And oftentimes they may give you some advice that's useful, and they'll also compliment you maybe on something you did that you didn't even think was that you were doing that was helpful. So you want to make sure you keep that in your repertoire.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Jean on the line in Dallas. Hey, Jean.
Hi. Thanks, Chris. Thanks for all you do. I wanted to share a success story, and I think that your guest is – what he says about networking is so important. I just went through an extensive job search, and as part of that search, I identified my 10 top companies that I wanted to meet with and potentially work with. And so I used LinkedIn to identify friends or colleagues or connections and ended up getting interviews with all 10 of them and ultimately narrowed it down to 2. And the way that I was able to get the position is that one of my connections kept putting my resume in front of the decision maker, not the hiring manager, the decision maker. And I ultimately got my dream job, but it took a lot of hard work, but it was all done through leveraging my network. I can't emphasize the importance of leveraging your network and being good about doing that. And that's my only comment, and I'll take the comment off the air.
Well, Jean, that's great news. I'm glad to hear that it worked out for you, and thank you for sharing that information. I'm guessing, Dwayne, that's something that you would agree with.
Oh, yeah, no, it's great. And thank you so much for calling in and sharing that. And success stories are so important for people listening. And you're 100% right. It's constant. You have to leverage your network. And you sound like a person that really understands how to use LinkedIn. And it is hard work. I love what she said. It's hard work. You know what? It is hard work. I mean, it's not, you can't say anything worthwhile in life is going to be hard work. And so looking for a job, you shouldn't think otherwise. And I mean, think about it, LinkedIn is relatively new. I mean, it saves so much time, and it's making life so much easier, for the modern job seeker today. I mean, 10 years ago, I don't think it's even been around that long. I mean, it was a lot harder. But there's, again, in the book, there's a whole section about, I call it the 4-5 rules of networking, and it's all about if you do what I suggest in the book, you will be so busy within several weeks of using the discipline, you'll be so busy networking and doing it the right way that you won't even have time to complete. And the chances are so great that you'll land a job within, 2 or 3 months doing this. And it was proven. I mean, there were people I interviewed for the book that did this, that actually used this discipline. and they landed jobs. You almost can't not land a job because you're basically reaching out. You know, you're talking to at least five people every day. You're reaching out via email to, you know, sending streams of communication that way and leaving voicemails every day. You respond to five job opportunities that you find on job boards or wherever it is, you know, you're looking for. You're responding. You're finding those opportunities. And then you're sending a resume out, okay? And then you have to follow up on all that. Well, if you think about it, that's you're doing, you know, five, 10, 15, 20 things every day in different areas of the networking scheme. You know, it's just incredible how busy you'll get because then you're going to have to be following up and it's the power of people that you have to get in front of people. And so that caller, you know, did the right thing. You know, she got in front of people and also got it to the decision maker and kept and did it in a tenacious way, you know. And again, there's nuance. I mean, she sounded like, I mean, she totally got it. You have to do it with, you know, a certain amount of finesse. You have to be persistent, but you can't be too persistent because if you're too persistent, it puts people off, right?
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372, and speak with Hugh in Dallas. Hello, Hugh.
Hello, good afternoon.
Hi.
I was wondering, what would you say to somebody who had some gaps in their resume where they weren't working but had some chance to travel or volunteer or do other things that they thought were valuable, but they sort of look like a gap in the resume?
The best thing to do is you want to be as transparent as possible, okay, because it's going to come out in an interview. And it's perfectly fine to explain what you've done. I mean, as you put together the resume, you know, you start at what job you're in now or the last job you had, and just kind of go down the list, you know, as you're listing whatever it is, and then, you know, whatever time you spent doing something else, you know, that should be slotted in there. There's nothing to hide. You shouldn't. You know, you should never try to hide anything because it will come out. And especially if you're dealing with recruiters, I talk to a lot of recruiters who say they'll have people come in and meet with them, and they'll, you know, they'll get, you know, the meeting goes well and everything's packaged, the resume's all set, and then the recruiter will send them off to the hiring manager of the company, and then, you know, I'm telling you, it's going to come out, and then it makes the recruiter look bad, it makes the job seeker look foolish, so. It's the first rule of thumb is to be honest and as transparent as possible. Obviously, you have to use common sense. I don't know, you know, how long the gap is, and you know, but I mean, you know, short of, you know, something that was, and I know you're not saying this, but if something was, you know, off kilter or really, you know, illegal or something, I mean, you know, you have to be smart about it. But I mean, you know, you don't ever want to tell a fib or a lie because it will come out.
Back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Martin in Arlington. Hi, Martin.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi there.
So my question was specifically for college students about to graduate, mentioning the LinkedIn account. If you have limited work experience and you're not so familiar with it, do you have any advice on somebody about to graduate and how they would go about that?
Look, I mean, yeah, set up an account. Make sure you put a professional-looking picture up there, more of a headshot. Don't use a Facebook picture with a hat on sideways. You know, helps to have like a dress shirt or something because you want a more of a professional image. All right, there's a summary section you can put in there. You know, just graduated from whatever college it is, interested in doing XYZ, that kind of thing. Looking for new work. Or looking for work in this type of field, here, and then put in there, perhaps you've done some volunteer work, or you've done some work at school, you belong to a club, anything that you can put on there that shows. I mean, look, it's totally understandable. People are coming out of school; everybody has to start at the beginning, at some point in their life. But it's very important to start that, you know, because what it does is it's a placeholder. It has you out there. And then put your keywords. You graduated, economic major with a minor in business finance, da-da-da-da-da-da, so that now all of a sudden, if a recruiter is looking for an entry-level person with an economics background, financial experience, and that kind of thing, you will come up. And that's the whole point of having that.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for your call. How can we decide if we want to use the services of someone like a recruiter or a headhunter or a job placement service? And what are the sort of pros and cons of that approach?
As far as should you use a recruiter, you're asking me?
Right, exactly.
Well, I mean, look, if you're looking, you're out of work, you lost your job, you should definitely, identify recruiters in your field, and you should reach out to them. You should, so it's not even about a decision. You want to, usually there's a few companies that specialize in your field. Like for me, communications, there's a handful, half a dozen, specialty companies that do placement in the world of corporate communications and PR agencies and things. And then there's solo players out there, people who, are just specialists. They work from their home or wherever, who knows where. You want to reach out to them, either meet them in person, make sure you send them your resume. Look, they're looking for people all the time to fill their job. They get paid. You don't pay them. They get paid by the hiring company. So, they're only as good as their database. So you want to reach out and make sure you're on the radar of the recruiters in your field.
Ultimately, what's really interesting about your story is that what you decided after this search was that the best job for you was one that you created for yourself.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, I didn't realize it but at the time, but I was sort of reinventing myself and resetting myself as I was writing the book. I mean, for me, I lost my job. I met with a friend of mine, Mika Brzezinski, who's co-host of Morning Joe Show, and she's been a friend going back decades. And, when I explained to her my situation, she said, "You need to write about this. That's a skill of yours. You're a writer, and you could help thousands of people telling your story because you really articulate it, and there's a certain empathy and a certain vulnerability." And I also had access to some interesting people. I interviewed, a cross-section of America, job seekers and psychologists and psychiatrists. And I interviewed business moguls like Donald Trump and Mort Zuckerman and comedians like Larry David from Seinfeld and all this advice and anecdotes. And so, what happened was while I was looking for work, I needed something else because I'm a very type A, very, I make things happen personality. And in order for me to keep my sanity, I needed to be feeling like I was moving forward. And so, but what happened was I'd never done a book before, so that was a huge challenge. And so that kind of helped me get my head around, moving forward. And then what ended up happening is I couldn't find a job. The long and short of it was that, it's about landing work. It's not necessarily about finding a quote-unquote job, okay? And that means maybe you're going to find a job where you do what you did before, and a lot of times that doesn't happen now, or reinvent yourself. Maybe you start your own business.
I'm going to have to jump in here because we're out of time. The new book by Dwayne Schenck is called Reset, How to Beat the Job Loss Blues and Get Ready for Your Next Act. Dwayne, thank you so much for being with us.
It was great being with you. It's a great show.
Dwayne Schenck was with us today as part of KERA's One Crisis Away initiative. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.